I'm going to ask you to listen closely, okay? I'm not going to have you to turn any passages. I have somewhat of a different approach to the sermon this morning, and by now some of you probably are like, well, you say that every time you preach. Well, I guess it's unanimous, I'm just a little bit different. Don't agree too quickly, Lily. You didn't say anything? Okay. I beat you to the punch. Anyway, what I want to do today is use stories and Bible stories to share this message. But before I get into that, I want to talk about the time of year, the season we're in. We're nearing the end of summer, and I love the transition from summer to fall. I love fall weather. I love the cooler temperatures. I love the changing colors, the beauty of it. I used to love fall because it meant that I was nearing the end of my work season with lawn care and I'd soon get a several month break. I still love the beauty of it, but that has changed now. And I love fall weather. I'm not a big fan of middle of summer heat. That's just not me. But that's a season of the earth. That's a cyclical season that comes every year. We see those seasons. But there's a different type of season I want to discuss today. And that's the seasons of life. I'm not trying to be critical when I say this. But if we really stopped and pondered how we react to people when we see them, our first impression, what comes to mind when we see them, I think we'd be surprised if we really, really evaluated what goes through our mind. And I'll explain a little bit. How many times you see a person and you silently could critique them based on what you see, like, why are they dressed like that? Or why are they doing that? Or why do they look like that? Or why aren't they trying to do more? You know, there's this immediate reaction in our head. I know personally, it's very easy to pass judgment on a person based on what I see. It's a human reaction. I don't think it's wrong because it's just a mental reaction to what you see. But where it becomes a problem is when that reaction in your mind then translates into how you act. You develop an attitude towards them, or you base how you respond to them upon what you have seen or heard or whatever. And I hope this is making sense. Some of you are nodding. Some of you are maybe, I don't know. But hopefully by the time we're done, this will be cleared up. I saw a meme on Facebook some time ago, and it said, never judge a person based on a season. And then it went through a list of several Bible characters that did this first, and then all of a sudden, later in life, they were doing this. And it was an amazing changeover. We all go through seasons in our lives. There are seasons of youth. Like, I look at Josh, and I think about all the troubles he has in life and the incredible burden life is on him, and just, he has a lot on him right now. You can tell, it's weighing him down. Seasons of youth, the seasons of young married life, the seasons of being parents, maybe the seasons of being empty nesters, seasons of being grandparents and great-grandparents, and then seasons of twilight years, and that brings its own challenges as I'm seeing. But amid those normal seasons of life, we have other seasons that we go through that can change from week to week, even day to day sometimes. We go through seasons of discouragement that hopefully can become rejoicing at some point. We go through seasons of bitterness that, by the Lord's grace, can become forgiveness, hopefully. Maybe financial problems that maybe also we could have some financial successes. We go through seasons of poor health, and by God's grace and mercy, maybe some good health. But with each of these seasons comes with it a mental change or a mental reaction, an emotional makeup. Depression could lead us to isolation and really not want to be around anyone. or feeling joyful and excited can lead us to want to be with people and really enjoy doing it. You know, we could go through a lot of scenarios, but a season of life that we're in drastically affects our emotional state and how we react to life. Therefore, is it fair to judge a person based on what you see? What season are they in right now? The fact that they don't want to talk to you, it probably isn't because they're mad at you. It's that they're dealing with something and they don't want to talk to anyone right then. And so there's something that I've been trying to work through in my life here in the last 4 or 5 years or more. I try not to judge a person based on my first evaluation of the situation, because I know that every response and every season, if you will, is caused by an underlying issue. You're sad because of something that happened. You're happy because of something that happened. And I know that I wouldn't want someone looking at me and judging me based on the first thing they see in my life. So I don't know if this is still making sense, but I want to take 5 Bible stories, accounts of people that started out in what we would probably judge as probably not the greatest, and turn around and wow. One season, David was a shepherd. The next, he was the king. Let's talk about David. David was the youngest of his family. David took care of sheep. He was well known as a shepherd. However, when it came to wartime, he was too little, and he felt left out. And it's obvious when we read that passage about David going to visit his brothers and bringing the food from his dad that he was annoying to them, which really is a typical older brother response to a younger brother. I mean, that little brothers, little siblings, are annoying. Just that's the way it's designed to be. Let's not go any farther at the moment and just examine David's life right then, okay? He was young. He sat out in the field and played with his harp and watched the sheep, and he annoyed his brothers, right? How many times do we hear and read this story and we feel bad for David, and we think how unkind his brothers were to him? But stop and think about it. Would we be any different? Don't sometimes we as adults look at children and youth as annoying? They're in the way sometimes. They make noise a lot. And sometimes they get smelly. That's the way it is in our house, though. I don't know if you have that same problem. But what if we were in that situation? Would we have judged David as too young, too immature? Just no. He was a shepherd. How would we have reacted to that? I mean, really, David, can't you do anything better than sit out in the field and play with sheep? I mean, play on your harp? That's pretty lame. Doesn't that sound like something we might think? Maybe not say it, but maybe think. Sure, there's something better he could have been doing. Well, what did Samuel say to Jesse? For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. The season David was in right then was a season of learning, season of growing, season of maturing. The Lord was preparing him for something big. And as humans, we see the here and the now. And looking on to David's situation, we probably wouldn't have ever imagined where he would have been years down the road. But what happened? God was indeed looking on the inside, not on the outside, and what David would become. And David became one of the most famous kings in Scripture. And reading from the book of Acts, and afterward, they asked for a king, so God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. And when he had removed him, he raised up for them David as king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do my will. David was called a man after God's own heart by God himself. So one season he was a shepherd, the next he was a king, and a man after God's own heart. That's quite a turnaround. And I'm pretty sure none of us would have expected that if we were there watching. What about Ruth? One season she was working in the field, the next she owned the field by marrying the owner. You should all know this story fairly well, but a little refresher. Elimelech took his wife Naomi and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, from Bethlehem to Moab. They moved. And Mahlon and Chilion found wives in Moab. Now, this wasn't ideal. Their names were Ruth and Orpah. From their home country, they would have been told, you need to marry your own people. But their own people wasn't available, so they married what they had. And sadly, all the men die. Not at the same time, but they all die, leaving the women as widows. Naomi decides that she needs to move back to her home and told her daughters-in-law to stay there. I have a sneaking suspicion, it's not mentioned, but I have a sneaking suspicion she was trying to save them some embarrassment and some rude comments is why she encouraged them to stay. But Ruth would have nothing of it. She said she's going home with her. So they return, and a few days later, Ruth knows we need food. So she goes to the field where they're harvesting, and she tries to scrounge around and grab some of the leftovers that fall down. That would have been humbling for any person, let alone a stranger in a strange land that probably wasn't viewed very favorably. Well, Boaz caught wind of this and was watching her, and he was really impressed because he had heard how Ruth treated her mother-in-law. And he told his workers, drop a little extra for her, make sure she has plenty. Eventually, after a series of events and customs that were normal then, Boaz takes Ruth as his wife. So Ruth went from gleaning in a field to owning the field by being married to Boaz. Now, I think we all love the story of Ruth, girls especially. I mean, it's a beautiful, mushy love story that makes them all giddy and giggly, right? But what would we have said if we were around back then, the time of Ruth? What would we have said about Ruth? I mean, she wasn't native to Bethlehem. What's this foreigner doing pushing her way in? She doesn't belong here. And then when she started working out in the field, be like, look at her slinking along like some kind of a street urchin. I mean, have a little self-respect, Ruth, right? Well, okay, so I hope none of us would say those things to someone. But we might think them. But isn't that how humans respond to someone? They see what's going on, they make an immediate judgment call. But the amazing thing about this is God wasn't seeing Ruth at the moment where she was at, but rather at the moment where she could be. The fact that Ruth changed that much in her life, that in itself is a really cool story. But the most awesome part of that story comes later. Remember that guy David we just talked about? And I believe probably most of you already know this. But let me read from the last couple of verses of the book of Ruth. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a close relative. And may his name be famous in Israel. And may he be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons, has borne him. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him. Also the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, there is a son born to Naomi. And they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. You catch that? Ruth was David's great-grandmother. Isn't that pretty incredible? The woman who looked like she wouldn't amount to anything, who had the choice to stay in Moab, she chose to go to Bethlehem, and she became the great-grandmother of one of the greatest, if not the greatest, king in Scripture. But that's just the beginning of that story. Because if you go to the first chapter of Matthew, and you look through all the boring genealogies, you'll see about 27 generations after Ruth came along this guy named Joseph, who was the earthly father of Jesus. Now, would we have looked at Ruth and said, yep, in about 27 generations, she's going to be the great-great-great-whatever grandmother of Jesus Christ? Likely not, but that's an incredible turnaround, isn't it? One season in life doesn't dictate the final story. So another one. Most of you should recognize the name of Esther from Scripture. Pretty impressive story, much like Ruth's, another kind of mushy love story. Well, in a way, but not... It's still, yeah. Anyhow, I don't want to talk about Esther. I want to talk about her uncle Mordecai. Technically not her uncle, it's her cousin, but I think probably he's commonly referred to as her uncle because he was like an uncle or a father figure to her. I think he raised her, really. Well, the king got drunk one night and made some very wise decisions, and he asked his queen to come and dance for him, and she, of course, didn't do it, which kind of ticked him off, and he just got rid of her, which was obviously the logical thing to do. I mean, that just makes sense. And the next day when he sobered up, he realized that probably wasn't the best move in the world and was having second thoughts. But because he's the king and he didn't want to look stupid because he already made a rule, I can't undo that, so I'll just get another queen. That would be sensible. So he called all the pretty girls in the kingdom to come by, and I'm going to pick one for me to be my queen. Well, from what we understand, Esther was very beautiful. And she was obviously a candidate, but she was a Jew. But they kind of left that part out. And guess what? She was chosen as queen. And that, of course, is making a long story short. And of course, Mordecai, being related, was also a Jew. And he wouldn't bow down to any man in power, any person. And that kind of bothered that jerk that the king put in named Haman. He was kind of upset about that. So Haman devised a scheme that would wipe out all of the Jews, which obviously was a rational response to one person are irritating. You just wipe out their entire race. On such and such a date, they were all taken care of, and he was happy. Well, word got back to Mordecai, and he decided to make a public scene of his mourning, doing the customary mourning ritual of wearing these rags made out of sackcloth, like burlap, I guess, and sitting in ashes and walking around and just wailing and crying a lot. And this, of course, caught Esther's attention because he was right out in the middle of the street. And through a series of very convincing pleas and begs from Mordecai, Esther agreed to go to her husband, the king, and see if they could figure something out so their people would not be wiped out. When the king realized that Haman had tricked him, he decided it was time for Haman to hang out back for a while and promoted Mordecai to Haman's position. And because of his authority, Mordecai was able to advise the king in a way of reversing, not the decree, but reversing the operation so that it wasn't carried out. So Mordecai went from this little known Jew to a man through God's help who saved the entire Jewish nation. Stop and let that sink in for a minute. We wouldn't have Jews today if it wasn't for Mordecai. So again, let's put ourselves at that scene. We see Mordecai walking around in rags and crying and sitting in the ashes and just making quite a scene with his wailing. And we're like, Mordecai, you're making a scene. Be quiet. You're embarrassing. Don't you have any pride? You're a freak, right? Our tune would have changed a few days later. Oh, wow, Mordecai, God bless you for your courage. What a change you've made. You've done so much. But yeah, from the first appearance, Mordecai really did look like a nut job. But yet God was doing something incredible through him at that time and through that unpleasant season in his life. And through his obedience, an entire nation was saved. It's a good thing that God doesn't judge people based on one season in their life, right? There's another guy I want to talk about moving into the New Testament. We find a story of a pretty messed up guy. It's found in the book of Mark, and it's pretty popular because Matthew and Luke also recorded it. This guy was possessed by a whole host of demons. He was bound by chains, but because of the demon possession, he would break the chains and then run into the cave that he lived in and cut himself with rocks or whatever sharp objects he had. When Jesus showed up on the scene, he purposely went there. The guy with the demons told him to stay away. Well, the demons were actually saying stay away. They didn't want anything to do with Jesus. And Jesus said for the demons to come out of that man. And the demon says, no, don't just send us away. Send us somewhere, like into those pigs over there. So Jesus was only too happy to oblige and sent the pigs running pell-mell down the hill and over the cliff and into the sea and made this rather unpleasant ham soup, I'm assuming. But a little while later, this guy, the same man possessed with demons that wasn't controllable at all, was sitting quietly at the feet of Jesus asking questions and learning. What would we have said in that situation? Stay away from him. He's dangerous. He's something wrong with him. He's messed up. He's not safe. Quite disgusting, really. But Jesus wasn't looking on the outside. And what a transformation. He went from being an uncontrollable menace to being a silent listener and learner. That would be amazing in itself. But it didn't stop there, because when Jesus went to leave, the man begged to go along, but Jesus says, no, you need to stay here and tell others about me. And in Mark 5:20, it says, and he departed and began to proclaim in Decapolis and all that Jesus had done for him, and all marveled. Now, at first glance, at that guy initially, no one would have thought he would be proclaiming the good news of Christ a few moments later. What a season of change he went through because of Jesus Christ. This next one is probably my favorite story in all of the Bible, at least up there close to my favorite stories. Jesus told his disciples that he needed to go through Samaria one day, which is a no-no for any self-respecting Jew, because those Samaritans were half-breeds and they should have nothing to do with them. And little did his disciples know that Jesus intended to meet up with a pretty sketchy woman there. I'll let that sink in for a little bit. That is literally what happened. So they go to the well, and Jesus waits there while his disciples go to get food. This woman comes to get water, and Jesus asks for a drink. And from that request came a very interesting conversation, which involves how many husbands the woman went through and if she's married currently and so on and so forth. What would we have said if we watched that interaction and watched that woman? Forget what the gossip hounds would have said about Jesus, because that's another story for another time. What would our response be about the woman? What in the world is she doing? She already messed up how many marriages, and now she's hitting on Jesus? How quickly do we view someone who's lived a very perverse and immoral life, and we view them with disgust? Because it's honestly a normal reaction if you're trying to live a clean life. It really is. But how quickly should we look at a person with sadness when we recognize how much better their life could be with Jesus in it? And I'm glad it was Jesus that met her that day and not me, because he knew just what to do and just what to say. He had a plan already in place before he got there. And he laid bare, with just a couple of few simple statements, he laid bare her life. And they weren't harsh statements, they were just gently spoken facts. And this so moved the woman that she asked more, and then she obeyed what Jesus told her to do. In John 4:28, this is her reaction. The woman then left her water pot. Now, I did a little bit of just glancing study at this. Leaving her water pot was significant because that was what she came to do. It was so important what she was going to do that she left what she came to do to fulfill this task. She went her way into the city and said to the men, come see a man who told me all things I ever did. Could this be the Christ? Now, Scripture does not specify what men she went to see. In fact, some versions it just says people, and some say that it was just the people of the city. I'll tell you my opinion. I'm not saying I'm right. But I think she went back to those men that she was married to and went back and witnessed to them and shared with them a better way. But then listen to the result, John 4:39. And many of the Samaritans of that city believed in him because of the word of the woman who testified, "He told me all that I ever did." Now, I don't know if this story pricks you like it pricks me every time I hear it, but our normal reaction of judgment on this woman would not have encouraged her to do what she did. Jesus' proper example of how to treat a person shows us the impact of how loving a person can make such a change. And listen, what a turnaround. In one season, she was going from man to man, living a very immoral life. In the next season, she was going from man to man, sharing the gospel. Isn't that incredible? I bet no one saw that coming, and I doubt any of us, if we were there, we would have thought anything was possible like that. And I get excited when I read that story and hear it, because God can turn a life around even when we think there's no hope. So let me wrap this up by saying this. I don't know where you're at, and I trust that the way I brought this out, understand, I'm not saying you guys are nasty in your thoughts and you accuse people. I'm just talking about humanity and how we tend to respond. Maybe you're in a season of life where you personally think this is never going to end and there's no hope and it's not going to get better. Or you may see someone and you're really questioning that season they're in and wondering what in the world, and you have some judgments and thoughts in your mind about it. Just remember that we have a God in heaven who turns things around. He's a God of unmerited favor, undeserving mercy, and unending love. He sees things that we'll never see, and he can take something incredibly ugly, an incredibly ugly situation, and make something amazingly beautiful out of it. Stand with me, please.